Welcome to another EbizQ podcast.
EbizQ listeners, this is Jessica Ann Mulla, managing editor of EbizQ. Today, I have two people on my podcast. I have Mamoun Yunus, who is CEO of CrossCheck Networks, and John Wilbright, who is the CIO of Omega Financial. Mamoun and John, thank you for joining me today.
Thank you.
First question I have, and you can both answer this, is how would you define cloud computing, and are SOA, or service-oriented architecture, and cloud synonymous?
Well, Jessica, I think the way I look at it is that I like to see the definition that the National Institute of Standards and Technology, or NIST, has put out there, and it really defines it through five essential characteristics, the first one being that cloud computing has to be on demand, that a consumer can get to the services, provision it without any significant human interaction. Second being that you can have access to these services or cloud services through standard internet protocols such as HTTP, REST, SOAP, and XML. So there's no real proprietary network communication protocols to access cloud computing services. The third defining characteristic really is around resource pooling. So when a consumer is using a service, he's using some shared service, and once you're done using the service and deprovisions, then the same infrastructure gets used by the next user that comes in. The fourth aspect and how NIST defines this is rapid elasticity, meaning that if I as a consumer have a heavy traffic coming in and I haven't really planned for capacity, then I should be able to get more capacity turned into my infrastructure through simple invocation and request into the cloud saying, okay, now I need four more servers to run a particular operation. And the fifth one is that everything should be measured, meaning that I should only pay for what I use. From my perspective, cloud and SOA are not really synonymous. They're more supportive of each other. And the way we look at it is that SOA enables cloud computing. So once you've got a solid SOA infrastructure, you can extend and utilize that to get cloud services in place. And companies that are really positioned well for utilizing cloud services are the ones who have invested early on into building a SOA infrastructure.
I would say, Mamoun, I'd see it similarly. I would say they're not synonymous, although they're very complementary technologies. I see cloud computing from an implementation standpoint, because that's really the standpoint I come from, is a very sophisticated next generation, more modern time sharing that we've been used to through the years, where you can access virtualized resources, you pay for what you use, you can control those resources through some type of SOA environment that enables you to get in and out of that environment and through open standards. So being able to access that cloud of computing resources via internet protocols and standards-based message sets so that you can ramp up your infrastructure as you need it is kind of the way I see cloud computing. So access to virtualized storage, virtualized operating systems, virtualized application servers, database servers, and being able to grow and manage that on demand and pay for only what you use. To me, that's how I see cloud computing. On the SOA side, it's more of how you're architecting your systems from a message set, an orientation towards reusable components. And I think as you have your system where you have standard inputs and outputs and you understand what those are and they're defined, it makes it much easier to move that type of infrastructure into a cloud where you can then control it no matter where the location of the resource is.
Now, this question you can also both answer. What are the prerequisites to enabling cloud computing in an enterprise IT infrastructure, and what are the barriers?
Well, I mean, from our perspective, looking at the customer base, it's really been really two components that stand out. One, federated identity. Whenever one interacts with a set of services that are external to the enterprise, be it your trading partners, suppliers, or other entities in your value chain, or cloud services that may be infrastructure as a service, platform as a service, or software as a service, all of these type of interactions require a strong component of authentication and identifying who you are and what you have right, what authorization do you have to what services. So if you take a subset of cloud computing as and look at infrastructure as a service, you'll see that even within that, you've got a few major players like Amazon EC2, Rackspace, GoGrid, OpSource, and all of them require different type of token sets. So from an identity perspective, if you're not ready to authenticate yourself to these cloud infrastructure, you'll end up really building these one-off integrations as opposed to a well-abstracted integration into these cloud services. So federated identity will be the first aspect or first prerequisite to which I would recommend a corporation to look at before getting onto a cloud. The second one is interoperability and portability. So when you're dealing with a number of different cloud providers, one, you want to deal with a number of different cloud providers. You don't want to lock yourself in with just one cloud provider, just from a reliability perspective, as well as just from just generally avoiding vendor lock-in and keeping yourself in a good negotiating position from a pricing perspective. So the lock-in aspect can only be taken care of by having greater portability amongst these vendors from an image perspective, as well as from the messaging that takes place to provision and deprovision services. So portability and interoperability is a second bucket that I would focus on as an enterprise while looking at deploying a fairly robust cloud computing infrastructure. Now, as far as the barriers go, I think the technology barriers are fewer. It's more, and John and I talked about this over the years, that it's really becomes a legal and compliance barrier where enterprises have a hard time handing over their data, even if you give them the reassurances. So from an audit perspective, the corporate audit boundaries no longer just stop at your firewall. They're going into shared cloud infrastructure. And secondly, from a reliability perspective, I think there's been a little bit of recently outages in some of the more dominant cloud infrastructure providers. And those outages point towards a reliability issue. So mission critical systems would kind of be kept on the side, if you will, in deploying in the cloud, and more of the archiving secondary systems, if you will make their way towards the cloud much quicker just because of such barriers. So that's kind of our perspective.
Yeah, I'd say three or four things that kind of get you to a place where you can take advantage of cloud computing. One is, I think you have to spend a good bit of time on your architectural models and the designs of your systems so that you can create models that can be pushed to the cloud. If you want to take advantage of one or multiple cloud providers and scale up your infrastructure that way, you need to have models that you can push out there. So configuration management practices, how you design your network model, and then how you externalize that to other entities outside of that cloud environment, are, I think, are very important to get in place. I'd also say identity interoperability. As you take advantage of more of the cloud infrastructure, you're dealing with lots of different identity information tokens to get in and out of systems, and that's being able to mediate between one set of tokens and another set of tokens so that you can exchange identity through the cloud depending on what different providers' security standards are, I think is paramount. I would also say that, and this is more of a non-technical aspect from a requirement standpoint, but I think your company has to have very good risk management practices in place so that it can understand what the risks are associated with moving your infrastructure in an environment that you don't own and manage and control. So understanding what the service level agreements are, what the security requirements are, what the different types of things that could possibly go wrong, the scalability and meeting peak demands. Those are risk management practices are extremely important to be able to enable your enterprise to be ready to take advantage of cloud computing. I'd say on the barriers is a lot around regulatory oversight, depending on what industry you're in, but definitely myself coming from a financial perspective, privacy of data of individuals that our company owns. You have external compliance regulations, whether that's federal guidelines or PCI guidelines for credit card information and how you protect that. And so I think encryption is a big thing that the cloud computing needs to really look at to make sure that that data as it gets put in there does not find itself into somebody's hands that is not supposed to be there. And then I think some of the other barriers are around security and how you manage security in the cloud. It's really what, as well as bandwidth, especially from things like a database replication perspective. If you are replicating very large databases between infrastructures to run your applications, access to bandwidth from remote locations from where your IT organization is, as opposed to where the actual data is extremely important.
Now, I have two questions for both of you. One is, what are your predictions for cloud SOA adoption in 2010? And do you consider the current economic climate as hurting or helping SOA cloud adoption?
Well, Jessica, from our perspective, I think if you just look at the definition of SOA itself, it's all about reuse. So in theory, in a tough economic environment, enterprises should be looking at leveraging what they've already built, what are reusable components, composite applications, web services, and so on. So they should be taking a strong look at the inventory of services that they have and which ones they can leverage and use rather than build and fund a brand new set of services. So those that have gone down the path of building a SOA infrastructure would want to look at what they have in place and leverage that. The use will definitely increase in a tough economic climate. The second aspect of it is that from an enterprise perspective, I'd be looking at, do I need to rent something or own something? So do I want a CapEx? Do I want a monthly expenditure coming in for the services that I use? So instead of building a project that may or may not be core to my business, why not look around for software as a service providers and just pay a monthly fee to tie it into my SOA infrastructure? So I think from an economic downturn perspective, there should be drivers to have enterprises adopt that. Whether they spend more money or not is a separate question, but from an adoption perspective, it should be a stimulus for enterprises to adopt that. So in general, I think people are looking at doing more with less, and they should be looking at both SOA and cloud adoption very carefully.
Yeah, I would agree with Mamoon on that point. Especially small to medium-sized businesses or businesses that entrepreneurial businesses that are trying to get started, the first investment dollars that they have or that venture capital or what the money that they're putting up, those are very expensive dollars. And to spend those dollars on capital investments such as infrastructure, servers, or storage is probably not the best use of those very expensive dollars. So I think startup companies, entrepreneurial companies, small to medium-sized businesses, it makes more sense to be able to go out and pay for that service as you go. So I see the economic climate is actually helping that cloud computing architecture to grow. And I think because of its close tie with SOA, it's also going to push more SOA adoption just naturally, because by taking advantage of these services, businesses do not have to build them themselves. They can reuse what other people have built.
What are some of the architectural moving parts that you think are necessary for building SOA?
Well, Jessica, from looking at it for the last decade or so, if you look at the entire SOA life cycle and start upstream, there's development and testing aspect of actually building and testing the services that are going to be deployed within a SOA infrastructure. And then once they are deployed, doing the runtime governance that includes security monitoring of all the REST and SOAP transactions that are flowing to the enterprise and to their external trading partners. So looking at all those development, testing, and runtime components that include both identity and security, so those would form the foundation. So I would kind of break it down into development and testing tools, cloud gateways or XML gateways, and identity brokers for identity mediation as being the three big categories for all of architectural moving parts.
I see similarly, there's kind of a development part to this, and there's a runtime governance part. From the development side, obviously standards are extremely important, so you need to know how you're going to do business, and you need to define that, and you need to communicate that with the parties that you're trying to interoperate with. You need to be able to lead with architecture. So I think architecture is a prerequisite to really having a strong SOA implementation. Around that architecture are things like monitoring, security, and also runtime governance. That is, I think, one of the most important aspects of it. So you need to be able to monitor your systems. You need to be able to virtualize your services so that you can extend them out to multiple different types of partners. And you need to be able to manage that from a configuration management perspective. So I think there's just a lot of different types of things, monitoring, again, standards, architecture, config management practices, standards that are extremely important to have in place. And then overall, I think there's a governance program that looks at your SOA implementation and manages that, whether it's performance issues or non-adherence to standards, and is able to communicate that to the constituents that are the consumers or the suppliers in the SOA environment and can keep them moving towards the target state.
Now, John, you are the former CTO of Synovus Financial. A few questions for you. What real-life business applications have you built that are based on SOA?
I've built a number of different applications, from deposit origination systems to loan origination systems to payment systems to mobile banking solutions, mortgage origination, brokerage integration.
And can you share with us the scale and scope of some of those systems, like the number of partners, transactions per year, and so on?
Sure. We had about 20 partners that we had in our SO environment, and they play both consumer roles and supplier roles. And those partners would either consume services so that they could deliver applications for our customers, or they would supply services into our SOA network to provide those to other consumers that were building applications. So we might be building a mobile banking application, and we'd have two or three suppliers of services that we could link into our SOA network in order for that provider to provide the data that's needed for that mobile phone application. From a scale and a scope, Synovus has been doing SOA for about 3 or 4 years, so it's has a very sophisticated implementation. And from a message perspective, there's probably 700 services in their system. And I'd say probably a good 100 of those services are heavily reused among many different applications. And there's probably 20 to 30 major applications running through their SOA environment. And then as far as capacity, you're probably looking at over 1 billion transactions a year running through that system.
Thanks for clarifying that. Now, can you compare and contrast the scale and scope of some of the deployments at Synovus and now at Omega Financial, where you are CIO? And at each firm, why did you choose the components you did, and what were the advantages and disadvantages of your approach?
It's kind of hard to exactly compare because we're in different businesses and our consumer base is different. I think the approach that we had at Synovus was definitely so as it applied really to message sets and integration of applications and kind of a single view of the customer. So we were constantly dealing with multiple providers that needed to exchange information on a standard protocol for interoperability between applications. And that was primarily 95% of the focus of SOA. At Omega, it's slightly different. We're not as concerned so much with interoperability and message sets at the message set level as much as we are interoperability of services and components. So we're looking a lot more at technologies like REST and Web 2.0 and reusable components in our system, being able to portalize functional parts of GUIs and be able to share those across many different applications because of our consumer base is so varied, and we need to be able to reuse these more portalized portlet type of components. Our approach here at Omega is much more focused on reusing the GUI side and the Web 2.0 side, and then interoperating with lots of other cloud services like Facebook and LinkedIn and many of these other very rich social networking, and be able to bring that data in and augment our database so that our customers have a more rich experience with the data that we keep on our customer, and we can bring that together. So that's really kind of a very different focus from what we were doing with SOA at Synovus, which was more around integration between systems at a message level. As far as the components that we use some similar components, mostly from a runtime perspective, on policy enforcement points and identity federation, and being able to manage and manipulate identity. Security is a key component for SOA, whether you're doing Web 2.0 or you're doing SOAP and message set integration. Identity is you have to lead with identity and security, and you have to have policy enforcement points. So those would be some things that are similar. Different things that are different would be things like we don't use composite application engines here, whereas I did use that at Synovus. So there's a lot of different technologies related to dealing with SOAP and message sets and orchestrations that I used at Synovus that we don't use here. We use a lot more portal technology and reusable GUI components and REST services at Omega.
Well, thanks for sharing that, and thank you again, John, for joining me today.
Thank you, Jessica.
This has been an EbizQ podcast.